Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
And welcome to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. From our Providence, Rhode Island studios, I sit down with Rhode Island television and web reporter Dan McGowan. Dan McGowan is a reporter for WPRI Channel 12 in Providence, Rhode Island, whose primary beat is covering Providence City Hall and Providence politics. Recently dubbed Mr. Providence by Jim Hummel, McGowan presents unmatched, in-depth, relationship-driven coverage of Rhode Island's capital city, building on both his own reputation for strong reporting as well as the legacy of the young, intellectually driven peer group of political reporters that has recently emerged at WPRI. Our conversation touched on Dan's journey as a reporter in Providence, challenges facing content creators in 2018, and how to adapt to them going forward, as well as a fun dive into Rhode Island politics and culture. All right, so we are here on a beautiful late spring morning with Dan McGowan, WPRI. As Jim Hummel said recently, Mr. Providence. And you're basically the beat reporter for the city of Providence for WPR, but also statewide. You're pretty much the guy right now.
Yeah, it's funny. It's was not necessarily designed that way, but the industry, journalism, not just television, has changed a ton. And when I came over to Channel 12 back in 2013, we talked a lot about owning Providence. We thought to move forward and to potentially, you know, chase down the big dog, meaning Channel 10, one thing that we needed to do was own Providence. I had already been covering Providence for the website Go Local Prov, and we really sort of dove into it. And it's so nice to have, you know, Hummel or, you know, anyone at PRO or just my colleagues in general in the media kind of recognize that. In part, it's a, you know, I benefit from the journal kind of cutting back, but I do think that title is, it's an honor to for people to recognize that, and I like to be the person that is always in City Hall, who always knows what's going on. I think it's important, all those things. So
right, and it's such a fascinating microcosm of Rhode Island politics. You know, within Rhode Island politics, oftentimes we spend a lot of time talking about the governor or Nick Mattiello, Speaker Mattiello, whatever it may be. But it's important to remember the past, present, and future of the city. Really, that's going to determine the fate of the state in a lot of ways.
No doubt. I'll tell you this. It's funny that people in politics that I've met in Rhode Island, I feel like you're in two camps if you're interested in politics. You either love City Hall or you love the State House. And I know lots of people who over the years have real, and it's whether it's because they liked or disliked Buddy Cianci, or more recently Mayor Cicilline, now Congressman Cicilline. People become sort of obsessive about what's going on in the city of Providence. Certainly that's the way it is at the State House as well. And I think it's important. I mean, look, the mayor of Providence, if you think about it, aside from probably the governor, the mayor of Providence is the most visible politician in the state, right?
Absolutely.
You're somebody who, generally speaking, if there's a crime in the city of Providence, there's a shooting, you're going to probably get harassed by the cameras, as you should. You're out front a lot more. So, I mean, in fact, when Buddy was mayor, he probably was by far the most visible and known politician in Rhode Island. I think Cicilline was like that. He battled back and forth with Don Cachiri for a long time. Mayor Taveras, you know, was running for governor kind of right away within a year of running for mayor, but he was out front. And I think Mayor Lohr, I think if you were to poll it, I bet Mayor Lohr's name rec is probably almost as high as the governor's or, you know, I don't know, maybe the speaker, because people really know. But does the average person know the speaker? I'm not sure. I think they know who the mayor of Providence is.
Yeah, most definitely. I would agree with that for sure, that just they're on another tier, if you will. Yeah. Maybe Alan Fung would be the third most recognized name, Mayor
right.
Fung.
And to his credit, because he has done the work, right? Like, Mayor Fung was a councilman and was has been the mayor for, God, four terms or something like that. So, you know, that's a guy who has built up credibility in this, you know, in the state of Rhode Island. I think the mayors actually think, to take it back a step, the mayors in Rhode Island for over the last decade have done, whether they've done a good job or bad job, have really have been stable forces in their communities, far more stable, in fact, than the state government. You know, when you look at Mayor Fung, I know Mayor Avedisian and Warwick just left, but he was there forever. Mayor Cicilline, Mayor Tavares, Mayor Alorza, people know them. You know, Mayor Lombardi in North Providence is considered a great mayor. Mayor McKee, before he became lieutenant governor, was a great mayor. So
Mayor Winthrop in Newport is well in and out,
absolutely.
But for sure, you know, he's there,
yeah.
Sort of omnipresent.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, it's an interesting role to have for sure, especially in you know, the shadow of Cianci. I mean, that's, like you say, whether you love him or hate him, that is sort of the standard for a politician in Rhode Island in terms of being open to the public, being open to the media. Do you find that Mayor Alorza is reachable and you're able to kind of get that Cianci-esque relationship going?
Yeah, you know, he's far different. No one is ever going to be like Buddy in the sense of, those type of sort of charismatic politicians. Again, for all the flaws, the charisma, those are kind of once in a generation, once in a lifetime in some ways. Politicians, it's why both when he died, but also when he ran for mayor in 2014, you had international coverage of that race. So it's different in that way, but to the mayor's credit, to Mayor Alorza's credit, he is generally speaking upfront with me. He gives me a ton of time to talk with him. We probably sit down in his office for an hour, I don't know, once a month, and then the staff and stuff, you know, I'm dealing with them literally every day, and, you know, certainly multiple times per day. So they're fine with that stuff. I think the mayor's drawn a lot of criticism. Some of it, I think, is fair, for not being as accessible, for the radio, for the willingness to go on camera at times. I think he likes to be on camera when things are good, and he's less likely to want to go on camera when things are tough, when there's a major crime, when there's something, the fountain controversy that's happening
sure.
on Federal Hill.
Well, it seems to be resolved. The flowers are out. Is that the
flowers are out? Although I will say, and maybe I'm in the minority here, I thought if you're going to have a broken fountain, obviously the number one goal should be to fix the fountain, of course. But if you looked at it, it was kind of nice. They put all these plants in. Like, they looked nice. They weren't just, like, random. It wasn't like they were weeds, like, growing
yeah.
out of nowhere. I thought they looked good, and then they took them out, and that thing's not going to get fixed right away. At least it doesn't appear.
Not for PVD Fest, which is ongoing, I think, right at
exactly,
the moment.
Exactly.
So.
Literally, it just, you know, just kicked off last night. So, I don't know. I mean, I thought it was a good. And you talk to people, and I understand, look, that's Federal Hill is a gem of a place. You know, it's kind of one of the places, Newport being another, like that. People know when they come to Rhode Island. Of course, you want that fountain working. I don't know, though, that having a fountain not working or needing to, as they've said, dig up the whole place during a busy season is the right answer. You know, I think they have in a couple of weeks, they have a big festival on the Hill. They have PVD Fest right now. I don't know. I would wait to get things done before, you know, rather than really piss people off.
Totally, yeah. And the flowers are kind of a down-home feel to them, too. Like, all right, you know, some individual, like, did it. You know
yeah.
what I mean? So, on behalf of the city, I'm sure. But,
right,
you know.
Right.
What do you think? Do you think it's the teachers' union? Do you think it's something else? And it certainly shouldn't be, but it could. But do you think people are concerned about the mayor's travels? What do you think will be the biggest challenge he'll have as he faces re-election?
Yeah, I mean, look, to be clear, he's going to have plenty of challenges, but to just, you know, the point stop here is he is an overwhelming favorite to be reelected. There is no one currently running that is that has the money, the name recognition, the organization to to compete with him in a really credible way. That doesn't mean they're not good candidates. It doesn't mean there are issues that are that they can't bring up. It doesn't mean they can't improve as candidates. But as of right now, the mayor is as much of a favorite, I would say, as any elected official in the state to get reelected of the major ones. You know, he does have issues, though. Labor is a big problem. You know, he's had to fight with, going back to when he first took office, he's had a fight with the clerical workers. That's a union in Providence. He's had a fight with the police officers, more over policy than money. He obviously had a very high profile fight with the firefighters for a long time. Now he's locked in this fight with the teachers, where you see the national president of the American Federation of Teachers in town kind of swinging away at him. That's a big deal. You know, the mayor would say, the mayor would not say this, the conventional wisdom would be that, look, there are many union employees that do not live in the city, that are not voters here, and so that is going to have a minimal impact on his reelection. As an example, the police officers, the firefighters, and the teachers all endorsed Buddy Cianci in 2014. They, you know, that didn't matter, and at least it didn't matter in getting him over the top. So there is that issue. That said, though, even if he doesn't have a re-election problem, it's a really bad thing when teachers they've been out of a contract since August 31st, right? They're going to go the entire school year this year. They could go into next school year without a contract. That's a real dispute that he needs to iron out, that will dog him potentially in his second term. That could hurt him if he ever wants to run statewide. That's when unions are going to matter to you. And, you know, in their eyes, they haven't been treated particularly well. Now, he would say different. He would say, I'm trying to be a fiscal steward here and trying to really, you know, to manage the budget well, all that kind of stuff. There are fair points to what he's saying. He's not entirely wrong, but he has not articulated, particularly with the teachers, he hasn't articulated his way around sort of the reasoning for, sorry.
Oh, it's all good, yeah.
The reasoning for the dispute, right? It's a money thing, but he, you know, he's tried to at least taken a step towards talking about policy, but he hasn't particularly articulated it well. So it does sound like, you know, the way the teachers are kind of presenting it is you've got a cheap mayor who doesn't like teachers. That's not entirely true, but it's a good way to position it. And for the public to understand it, that's certainly an edge for the teachers.
Absolutely. Moving on, in terms of city government or influence, what have you found the city council, or are there any subcommittees? What do you think is the center of power in Providence?
So it's a heavily, I mean, look, the mayor is always the strong point. This is a mayoral dominant city. Like a lot of cities around the country, when you think about the school board, the mayor controls the school board. It's not elected. So, you know, the mayor has a ton of power, has a ton of oversight over, you know, literally every dollar that gets spent. In many ways, the mayor kind of controls. That said, the people I cover most, I probably cover the city council even more than I cover the mayor and spend a lot of time around those guys. Everything needs to go through committees. The city council finance committee is by far the most powerful subcommittee of the city council. The council has had ups and downs, right? So when 2015, when this mayor took office and this current council took office, you had an interesting situation where you had Council President Luisa Ponte get elected. And this is a guy who, you know, was the first Latino city council president. Pretty good story. Guy grew up in New York, moved here, had lost, early in his career, lost an election, and then had never really been challenged since after winning in 98. And he's a guy who's really smart. If you ask anyone, whether it's at the State House, whether it's in City Hall, guy who really understands politics, it's Luisa Ponte. And that was he really fought hard. He had previously tried to be the council president, couldn't get the votes, finally gets the votes. Problem was, personally, his life was not in good shape, and he ended up getting charged, indicted with, you know, with misusing his campaign account. That case is still pending. So a sort of rapid rise in power when you become the city council president, and then a really kind of sad downfall that still hasn't been concluded. I think the city council president is always, though, you know, it went to Councilwoman Matos, who, and then eventually David Salvatore is now the current council president. I think the council president is often the person who has the best temperament in city government. You know, the mayor's always trying to get his stuff done. 15 city council members are all kind of wrestling for their sort of their chance in the spotlight, but also what they want for their ward. They often say, you know, we're mini mayors, we're the mayors of our ward, of our neighborhood. And the council president kind of has to be that balancing act where you're thinking about the citywide stuff, but you're also one of those mini mayors in your ward, you know? So I think the council still does have a ton of power. Certainly they can be a real thorn in the mayor's side, in any mayor's side, if they don't have a good relationship. Right now, the relationship is pretty mixed. I would say it's generally more good than bad. But I think the council, that could change at any minute, because there's lots of things that make people upset and lots of like goofy, you know, little like a money here and money there that gets moved around that really flips relationships on their head.
What's it like for you as a journalist in Providence who covers Providence to kind of see the disparity from College Hill across, you know, through downtown and out to like Broad Street, for example, just with you know, on the eye test, if you will.
Yeah.
How does that impact how you cover the city?
I think it's significant. People talk about Tale of Two Cities, right? In the Crime Town podcast, it was the doctors and the lawyers lived, and the professors lived on one side, and the common people live on the other side of the river, things like that. I think that's real. I live in Mount Pleasant, and Mount Pleasant, I think, kind of has historically been a middle class, where a lot of the firefighters and teachers and police officers lived when they did live in the city, when they were required to live in the city. There's an east side feel in some ways. It's very residential. You do have a lot of homeowners, things like that. But when you look at the city, particularly when you look at like east side versus south side, obviously there's a huge Latino population on the south side, and there's generally more affluent, tend to be white population on the east side. We know that, obviously. It is interesting on the when it comes down to politics and covering politics. Politics is far more interesting on the south side. I think they care about it more. I think they're more interested in what their elections look like. They're more interested in especially the local stuff, because there's a real grasp, I think, of understanding that your council person can really help or really hurt you, right? If your council person is voting, you know, for car tax changes or whatever, that might be really good or really bad. The east side gets really involved, I think, in the when it matters most. They get really involved, certainly during mayoral elections. You saw there was a recall last year of Councilman Jackson. That was on an east side neighborhood that I don't think the organizational efforts could have been mirrored in virtually any other part of the city. So there's advantages there that all kind of stem from money. But it's interesting to cover. I don't speak Spanish. I wish I did. And so it makes it difficult sometimes to cover Spanish, you know, people who speak Spanish as their first language. That's a flaw. And that's, you know, I wish we had more reporters in general, including myself, that spoke Spanish. That would be good. But I do try my best to really have a good inroads to the people who really care about politics, whether it's on the south side. In fact, I think about, and it's not like a goal, I don't have a list of this, but I do try to know who the, let's say, like so-called power brokers are in various parts of the city, mm-hmm. just so I know I can always check in with somebody who I know in my neighborhood or where else, and usually unelected people. I try to, like, people are community people that really just have the pulse of what their community looks like. So even if I'm not always necessarily there, I'm not always on the south side, or I'm not always on the east side, but I do know what the general feeling at the coffee shops and the bodegas look like. At least I try to. And if I'm doing a good job, then I am on top of that stuff.
Yeah, I think it cuts through in your reports pretty well, you know, that you have sort of a, you know, a general feel for how something's going to impact the city or how it will be received by, as you say, those kind of brokers, mm-hmm. community brokers, if you will. You know?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. I think one of the advantage that I have more than anything else is just the length of time I've been a reporter here, right? So I've been covering Providence since 2011. That means I've covered, really 2010, actually, excuse me. So I've covered the very, very end of Cicilline. I covered all of Angel Taveras. I've now covered all of Jorge Alorza. That means various council members that you become with, you know, close with. I probably like you, I'd like to just sit and hear stories about, you know, whether you say the good old days or whatever. I had a great relationship with Buddy Cianci, a good relationship with Joe Paolino, you know, the former mayor. You know, if you think about, I've said this to people before, but the journal archives, the Providence Journal archive system, is just the best resource that one can have in journalism. You know, they used to have 2 and 3 reporters covering City Hall. So I've literally read, I would say, 85% to 90% of everything they've ever written about City Hall and Providence, dating back to probably the early 80s, right? Then, so you've got that amazing resource. Then you've got, you know, I knew Buddy, I knew know Joe Paolino. There are still people around that can fill in a link, and there are people that worked for all those guys that talk to me constantly that I can, like, say with pretty good confidence that there's this, you know, stretch from like the mid 70s through today that I have a pretty good sense of why things happened, what decisions were made, who the power brokers were, stuff like that. And that only comes with sitting with people, talking with people, reading a ton. It comes with longevity. So it's nice, and I'm always flattered when people say that, you know, oh, you cover Providence so well, things like that. The biggest advantage is having been here for a while, that you can fill in those gaps and you can really learn what happens in the city or what has happened.
Do you want to keep focused on Providence as far as career goals for yourself? Is that something you have in mind?
I do. Yeah. I do. It's funny. It's evolved so much. When I was a kid, I always wanted to be a reporter. I always wanted to be a magazine writer for a long time. I wanted to work for Sports Illustrated. That was the idea. When I was a kid, you know, I realized I wasn't going to like pitch in the majors. I was like, okay, I'm going to be a writer because that's cool. I get to be in sports. That's a great idea. And when I got, when I started, when I was, I don't know, probably 21 or 22, that sort of light bulb goes on and you kind of realize that, you know, politics is more interesting than it appears when you're 14, right? And I think, you know, I always say, like, I think I binge watched The West Wing around the same time that Obama got elected. So they're just, you know, and I think we're roughly the same age. I'm 31.
Yep.
Like
32.
So there you go. So
33. Oops.
I'm 32 in a few weeks. So,
yeah. Okay.
You know, you start to care about things that you start, you know, with the way social media works. Like, I started to see people really care about the 2008 presidential election. And then, like, I don't want to be left out. So you start to pay a little bit more attention. Obviously, Obama was like this transcendent figure. So you're like really interested in what that looks like. And so, you know, your opinion changed. I'd still love to work in sports. That would be fun. But one of the reasons, even after that, I went to grad school in Boston, and I still had the idea of I'm going to be a magazine writer. Probably, I think I probably shifted while I was in school to say, I want to go from sports to maybe write for like The Atlantic would have been the ideal job. And in the meantime, I was still living in Providence and I was paying attention to politics. I was writing for Go Local Prov. It was my first job while I was still in school. And I really kind of became obsessed with it. It was part because I was spending a lot of time around these old timers that were telling me all this stuff and I wanted to use all of it, right? That now, though, has become this kind of thing of when you start to see the decline of local journalism, the decline meaning just simply by the numbers, you realize how important that stuff is. I always say that if you go to City Hall on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, there's always something happening, and it's more often than not that you've got the elected officials, usually the council, you've got the mayor's staff, you probably have lobbyists who are, you know, trying to get something passed, and then you have me. That's it, right? There's no generally speaking, there's no member of the community sitting through a 2 or 3 hour finance committee meeting. Not that I expect them to by any means. There's no other reporter there. There's no cameras there. Now, they record their meetings, all that stuff, but it's really important to be the watchdog, to know what they're doing, to be able to tell people. And the number of times that you come across things that seem like they're just moving super fast, and you realize there's something interesting, not necessarily nefarious. It could be a good thing too, right? But the things that you just pick up by being in the room, by being present, and I really just, I feel more strongly about that than I ever have. I think being a local reporter it's something that is fun. It's exciting. I love living in Providence. I think it's a great city. And I like to contribute in some small way to trying to make it better through reporting. So I like it. You had Ted Nisi on your podcast. He and I are relatively close in age, and we've been friends. He was the guy that got me the job at Channel 12. And we talk a lot about how fun it is to really be able to cover such broad beats and really grasp it and really kind of be the go-to guys. I would never rule out necessarily going somewhere else, right? It's the politician thing, never say never, but I think it's fun. I like covering Providence, and if I'm one of the only people doing it, I think there's money to be made as a journalist and for my life. I have no intent of changing, at least not right now.
Yeah, you have this peer group. We talked about it on Ted Nisi's interview about, you, Tim White, Ted Nisi. It's sort of this new thing. I don't even know what it is. It's just it's intangible, but it feels like a breath of fresh air. Very unfiltered breath of fresh air. And unlike the, Channel 10, which they're doing great work for sure, it just feels a little bit more personal, a little bit more down earth.
I think thank you so much. I'm going to say thank you a million times in your podcast, but I do think that there's a lot that goes into this, right? So, and Ted went through this on your show a few weeks back, but, they take a chance on Ted. What he didn't say, I don't think he said on this podcast, was he sent applications or letters to everyone in the market and said, I want to do basically what Ezra Klein, now at Vox, was at the Washington Post, is doing for Rhode Island. I want to just own sort of the wonky stuff that's happening in Rhode Island. And everyone kind of dismissed it. They didn't say no. I mean, I'm sure people knew he was a talented guy when he was at the Providence Business News. It's clear. I can't speak highly enough about Ted. But Channel 12 said, yeah, we'll give you a shot. We like it. And then he killed it for 2 years. And then they said, you know what? Like, let's do another one. Ted, do you know anyone that would want this job? He was like, Dan McGowan knows Providence inside and out. Let's hire him. Suddenly, you had two of us who If you think about my broader beat, so I cover Providence, but I also cover education. Generally, that's around education policy. Ted covers business, he covers politics, he covers healthcare. If you combine us, if we're at our best, we are covering among the, 5 or 6 of probably the top 10 beats you could have in Rhode Island government. Now, do we wish there were more of us, not Rhode Island government, in Rhode Island? Do we wish there were more of us? Do we wish that, could we do our jobs better in many different ways? Of course we could. So those jobs are great. And then we have, I'll talk about Tim and Walt Buteau in a minute, but we have this great core group who have now been here for 4 or 5 plus years at Channel 12. Steph Machado, we have a person behind the scenes, Deanna Pinzone, who's an investigative producer, who just knows stuff. As a team, Steve Nielsen. I mean, we have all these people, I don't mean to name drop, all these people who have all kind of been around. We're all roughly the same age, and we all get along really well. We compete. but we compete with the other guys and we help each other. So then there's that. And then on top of it all, you've got two investigative guys, Tim White and Walt Buteau, who, like, they have, first of all, been around for a long time. Tim White's dad was here forever. Tim is as good of an investigative reporter as there is in the country. Walt has been here for a long time. He's as talented as there is, like, a day of hard turn of, for a story, who are mentors, right? I mean, literally everything we do goes through, like, just emails and text messages of like, hey, what do you think about this? I got this idea. I'm working on this. I'm going to the courts today. Can we, you know, do you need anything? There's such a like great amount of teamwork that happens that makes that happen. And it's really cool to watch it all come together. At our best, I think we're as good of a television station as there is in the country. We're not at our best every day for various reasons. And it's a hard, but if you look at, when, if you look at Tim White, I mean, awards aren't everything. That guy has won Emmy after Emmy after Emmy for investigative reporting. I mean, we have just such talent there, and just again, they're all good people. I mean, there's no, like, you go to work every day when, like, your friends are there. That's awesome. You know, I can't ask for anything more. And so that's, it's so nice, and it's such an honor, and it's so nice to be recognized for that. But even if we weren't being recognized for it, I think it's just a cool thing, and it's uplifting. It really is.
Yeah, it sounds like it, and it reads like it as well. You know, it sounds to me when I hear some, you know, radio appearance, let's say, that you do or Ted does, whatever it is, or just in general, the whole package deal, it sounds young, it feels fresh, and it feels collaborative.
Yeah.
And it feels fun.
Well,
it being back to that, you know, it's youthful.
Yeah, well, and you talked about one of the other things that's good. I think you said it sounds youthful, it's fresh. It's also authentic, right? So if you think about what, you know, Ted and I both live in Providence. He lives on the east side, I live in Mount Pleasant. We like kind of live, sleep, eat our beats. We care a ton about what we're doing, and so when we're interacting with people on Twitter, on Facebook, you know, all kinds of things like that, it's real. And I'm like, I enjoy interacting with members of the public. I like to, you know, get into it and spar over, like, you should have looked at this. Sometimes people are really right. I mean, the number of times that somebody has said, how come you didn't ask question X that has turned into two more stories is wonderful, right? You know, and I think one of the things that journalists, and it's not because of Trump or anything like this, it's just one of the things journalists need to do a better job at is really kind of listening and coming off of our perch. And I think journalism has moved in that direction greatly. It wasn't Channel 12 that came up with this idea, but, you know, meeting people where they are and talking to people and not just dismissing someone as a crank or whatever, you know, or as, you know, a gadfly that just, oh, you're always complaining about something. Look, there are people like that, no question about it. But, you know, it's nice to be able to just, it's kind of like, you know, long, long time ago when people would just write letters in and then like get a response out. Well, now I can get a letter 50 different ways, right? And if I expect myself to respond, I expect my colleagues to respond to others, because I think that helps keep that sort of that personal you know, touch. And I think that's why people really like local news too. You see Mike Montecalvo at church, you see Shannon Heggie, you know, you see me probably at the bar more than church. but you know, we're around, and I think people really appreciate that, you know.
Definitely, especially in Rhode Island. I think we love our, you know, local people, you know,
absolutely,
whether it's local news, local, yeah, you know,
what's the saying,
music,
right? You can see your, it's one of the few places you can see your congressman at Stop and Shop, right? And you're right. Local musicians is such a great example of, like, we know the five or six spots they're going to be every night, right? Like, that stuff really, really matters. And that's the value of being in a small place. And people say, oh, it's too small, or, oh, you know, don't you ever want to go to New York or Boston? Yeah, I'm sure it's wonderful to cover New York City Hall or Boston City Hall. I guarantee it is. I know the reporters that do it. I like covering Providence.
Yeah, it's definitely a special place in the universe. No mm-hmm. question about
no
that.
Doubt.
Where do you have your Facebook group, Inside Scoop on Providence Politics? That's a good example of that interactive journalism that you were kind of talking about. You're the first person to do that in the state to have that sort of forum, if you will. It was nice to see that.
Well, thank you. It's funny. It's born out of complete, total self, I don't know, arrogance, I guess would be the word, right? Back in 2014, I created it first as it was just named the 2014 Providence Marriage Race. I got smarter later to brand it with my name on it. And the idea was, I'm covering this race pre-Buddy, right? So this is before that, because there was like a 6 or 8 month run until Buddy got, you know, and then things really kicked off. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time writing about candidates, like proposals to fix potholes. And that's really important, but nobody cares, right? And it's not going to be on the front page, you know, above the fold on WPRI.com on a day where, you know, potentially there's a shooting, potentially there's a big weather issue. Like, it's not going to get prominent placement, nor should it. Like, the one person's proposal on any number of things. Believe me, I covered every idea that's ever been, you know, hashed in Providence. And so I said, you know, I had this Twitter something of a Twitter following. I knew people read me, but there wasn't, you know, you could go to like WPRI/Dan McGowan, but like people don't do that anymore, right? Like all of my favorite writers, I don't go to like it's not even ESPN anymore, but like ESPN.com, Bill Simmons. People need to just be able to find it somewhere. And I thought, you know, I'll create this Facebook group. And people say, like, now, because Facebook groups are really trendy, people are like, well, you were ahead of your time. No, truth is, there was Facebook page or Facebook group, and I happened to click group. There was no thought behind that at all. And so what I did was I initially invited, like, 400 people that I knew. And I knew that, like, cared about, mostly that lived in Providence, but I knew enough people that cared about what was going on. And it took off right away. Like, right away, because it was already a hot campaign season, even pre-Buddy, you just had people that were really into it. And at first, it was a little off the rails. I let people post whatever they wanted. There was all that kind of stuff. And I just took a step back and thought and revamped and tried to, like, rein in just people that were outright, like, I'm with this candidate, F all the other candidates. That's stupid. Set some guidelines and then reined it in and said, like, you know what, this is going to be about me. There is some arrogance. I want people to be able to find what I'm reporting. I feel like it's important. And then, you know, used it as a place that I would actually talk to people, right? And listen to what they had to say and listen when they thought my story was bad or biased or good. Ideally good. And it has now, you know, grown to 6,400 people. It's something that, you know, members of Congress and every elected official and, like, or many elected officials and certainly every staffer in City Hall is paying attention to on a daily basis. That's really cool to have created that. It was never the intent. It was literally all about self-promotion. And there's a great thing that has worked, that check. But it has become something else, and I want, just kind of like you and I were talking off air about sort of how to monetize podcasts and stuff, I feel like there's a way to find a revenue stream here of people who are obsessed with this thing. I don't know if it's live events or whatever, but it's always something going through my head, because I want to, you know, provide the content that people are looking for. You know, I know they're on Facebook, so that works, but you know, also finding a way to bring them off behind the, you know, bring them away from the computer and out to the public to, maybe it's podcasting, maybe it's through, you know, live events where you interview the elected official or whatever, those kind of things. I think you really, like, does build this kind of strong community. It's funny, it's corny to say, but it's true. Like, people, if you look at comments, you know, people police each other. I mean, they tattletale on each other. They compliment each other. I know people who have gone on dates because they met on my Facebook group. That is crazy.
That's nuts. The new Tinder.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's right. Those were interesting dates, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So So yeah, I don't know. I'm really proud of it, and I think it's substantive. You know, look, you're always going to have people who are angry for whatever reason, and that's always going to be a thing. I don't know how to fix that. By the way, people are allowed to be angry, right? They're allowed to. Not only are they allowed, sometimes and oftentimes they have a right to be mad about a decision that gets made or whatever. One of the things that I love, and I'm rambling on here, but the coolest part of it is when a policy change, not even major things, starts out by me reporting something, gets a bunch of reaction, and then results in a change, an improvement. And I'll give you an example. It's so little, but I this is my favorite example. Last summer, before the school year started, the Providence School Department was planning a fairly minor tweak to their high school graduation requirements. They were going to take out a requirement for a foreign language requirement. And the thought process was actually, it made sense, right? It was like, look, we're 30% English language learners already. So we have a ton of kids in this district that are already speaking another language. We'll remove this. We're not going to tell them they shouldn't take it, but like we'll free it up. We'll, you know, have some other class that maybe is more important or more valuable to your long-term, you know, career in college kind of stuff. So I wrote about it, kind of knew. I knew there would be something to it, but I just wrote little thing, and immediately people start to freak out. Not because they thought it was dumbing down graduation requirements or anything like that. They said, wait a minute, Rick and URI have requirements that say you need to take a foreign language. What are you going to do? And I was like, whoa, I never even thought of that. Went back to the district. They said, yeah, we didn't think about that either. They say, okay, we're going to send a letter to all the parents to let them know that their kids still should take a foreign language. And then, like, the State Department of Education, all from, like, a Facebook thing, steps in and says, hey, well, you know, you should have kind of worked with us. We could have lobbied the legislature to change, or the Board of Education to change Rick's, you know, entry things. And this would, because everyone agreed, like, there was some sense to it. It was not a bad idea. And it results, they end up folding it and pulling it back. And that is still a graduation requirement now. And I think they're probably going to work to tweak it. But all of that, like, this fairly significant change in policy ends up not happening because a handful of people on Facebook said, like, whoa, that's there's a red flag here. That's really cool. That does not happen every day. And so that's one of my favorite little stories of just a minor change that a community was able to do all online, really.
Yeah, it's the real deal. I mean, that's what journalism is. I mean, that's the non-entertainment presentation of journalism. And it's like, I don't know, it's almost like, you know, what you're doing with the Facebook group and in general, but what Hummel does, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of people who are doing things in a new and different way, and those are the things that seem to be getting results in terms of the media serving as the fourth branch of government. Yeah. You know
what helps too is whatever, however we're doing it, I do think the branding to it really matters. You know Hummel, right? Hummel's been around for a long time, but Hummel, right? People know Hummel. To nowhere near the same degree, I think in Providence, you're like, oh yeah, Dan McGowan covers the city. Ted covers the State House. Ian Donis, guys like that. Kathy Gregg at the Journal. Like, and there's a delicate balance that I think news outlets have to have because, you know, you don't want the reporter to become bigger than the brand, right? That's a real thing. But authenticity that we were talking about before, that comes with, like, okay, like, I go to Dan McGowan every day. I go to Ted Nesi every day. And so I think that goes into it. So whatever medium or whatever, like, entity we're working for or whatever, however we're doing it, nonprofit, for-profit, whatever, I do think it really helps to have someone that I know that if I'm getting screwed, I can call Tim White or Walputo or Hummel or anyone else, and they may help me, right? That's really, like, important in it. So I think that matters a great, great deal.
Yeah, especially with the legacy of Jack White and Jim Terracani. Yeah. You know, there's this place, Rhode Island, it has a tradition of investigative journalism.
Incredible tradition. You know, you think about some of the reporting over the years, you know, Mike Stanton at the Journal. I mean,
even Diana Kelsch at 10.
Absolutely. Diana was, you know, it was at 10. I mean, Jim Terracani, you know, he was still, you know, still reporting very actively when I started and really only retired once I got to Channel 12. I mean, that's a guy who knew everything. That's a guy who, you know, was willing to go to prison.
Yeah, he's the real deal. You know, he's a real artist. There should be a statue.
Yeah. And like Tim's dad won a Pulitzer Prize, you know, and then he made a great career in TV, right? He won a Pulitzer Prize, the Journal, and then made a great career. And then Tim is like, again, as good of an investigative reporter as there is in the country, and recognized that way, treated that way. People believe that within the industry. Mm-hmm. There's really great this great foundation of investigative journalism that you know, and it's corny to say, we all say all journalism should be investigative. I don't see that silo that we should all be thinking it in an investigative way. But you know, when the big story happens, the one that we're promoting, when someone, you know, the fire chief is golfing when he should be working, things like that, you know, like Tim White's going to probably be on that. And that's incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that clip where Tim White approaches that fire chief and he's asking him about smoking a blunt. And, you know, he's like trying to pass off as a cigar. And it's again back to that real deal. Just Tim White, nah, man, that's not a cigar. Yeah. You know, come on. And
I'll tell you, too. One of the things I've learned from Tim that I always keep in my mind, and this is way different for Tim than it is for me, but it's still something, a practice that I follow, is Tim knows that guy, that fire chief, or Representative Carnevale, more recently, a story we all worked on, that is often one of the worst days in a person's life, right? Like, the chief in Coventry, I think it was Coventry, right?
Yeah.
He knew what he had done.
Yeah.
He knew sitting down what he had done. Now his job was to try to convince Tim White that it wasn't a big deal. That imagine how agonizing that is to him. And one of the things I've learned from Tim that I didn't understand before I got to Channel 12 was, you know, I feel like there's this idea that oh, we just jump out of the bushes and jam you up. And Tim often says, like, those are great, you know, interactions, and those make for great television. That comes after every attempt to contact you and sit down and have a conversation. I've been through it, like multiple contacts, until you get to the point where you're avoiding us, to the point where we're going to stick a camera in your face and, you know, wherever you are. And there's a level of like empathy there that Tim has, and that I think all the good investigative reporters, and I understand it too, when I sit down with somebody and it's, you know, last year there was a councilman, Kevin Jackson, who was recalled. We talked about this before, and he'd been charged. He'd run this nonprofit forever, charged with embezzling from that nonprofit. Again, case not resolved yet. Also charged with mishandling his campaign account. And I sat down with him on the eve or a few days before he was going to be recalled. I know he's going to be recalled. He knows he's going to be recalled. And here we are sitting down, and I'm doing essentially a career obituary, right? Political obit, right? And I was upfront about it. Look, you're going to get recalled. I want your side of things. I want to talk about what your career has meant to you. This guy was on the city council since 1995, right? Mm-hmm. Long time. Virtually all of my life, right? And he cried while we talked because of, like, how, you know, how hurt he was by some of the things people say about him. Acknowledging, though, that, yes, he's charged with, you know, maintains his innocence, but charged with serious crimes. I could have easily just written a story that said, you know, this guy's likely to be recalled on Tuesday, and he had no comment. We sat down, had a real conversation. The night he got recalled, I remember I went to see him very late at night on the east side at a pizza place, and again, one of the, you know, that conversation with me must have been painful that day when you get recalled by like 93% of the voters in the neighborhood. Really painful. And he thanked me because of, for being fair. That's really cool. And I think understanding that and needing to, knowing that, that it's all that work we do that, you know, to expose bad things, which we do plenty of, you know, there is someone on the other side of it, and there is a real, like, understanding that, that it's a bad day when Tim White shows up to your door, when Parker Gavin, whoever, and, we, you know, we need to understand that, too. Doesn't mean we need to back off, doesn't mean we need to lighten it, nothing like that, but just understanding it. That's something I've learned from Tim that I guess I didn't know before, and it's definitely, I think it's made me a better reporter, it's made me more understanding, it's made me look and look at the world differently. And that's, it's a really just powerful thing that you just picked up along the way, you know?
Yeah, I think that's true of all arts and letters. You know, one, it's investigative at its core. That's really what it is. And secondly, empathy goes a long way in obtaining an understanding of the scenario you're trying to investigate.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the stories that sort of, at least initially contributed to me building a little bit of a profile or whatever was before I worked at Channel 12. I was bartending at the time, and I get a tip that there's a major party happening at the police chief's house. You should go. And I literally got off my shift bartending. I was bartending at Greg's on North Main Street.
No way.
Yeah.
I was just there yesterday for Death by Chocolate, actually.
Excellent.
And a lemon meringue.
Good plug. They should be advertising here.
Yeah, work out.
And so I get off the shift. I didn't even have a car at the time. So I literally walk from North Main Street over towards like College Hill area, which is where, or Wayland actually was where the chief lived. And sure enough, there's a massive party happening. That is a, it is a high school graduation party, right? And it was everything I reported it was. It was a pretty, you know, it was a good party. If I were a kid, I would have said, you know, I would have liked to be there. And, you know, I knew how important it was that, like, this, and I'm watching this happen, and I'm seeing literally the chief there, and in fairness to him, he was telling people to leave, but he was allowing children, kids, you know, 18 teenagers to leave with 30 packs over their shoulders, getting into cars, walking, some of them walking, but certainly some getting into cars. And that story obviously like raised my profile, because people are like, who the hell is that? And how did he get that story? But it also, you know, if I could do it over, I still would report it. It was totally news. It was totally, you know, this is the chief of police who at the time, I mean, Dean Esserman was his name. Dean Esserman was probably in that top 10 of like people you knew in Rhode Island of like most recognizable officials. Right. And the major regret that I have, I gave the city plenty of time to comment. I literally woke the communications director up at 2 a.m. For Mayor Tavares at the time. And I got yelled at and I said, you need to like get yourself together. It's 2 a.m. You're obviously sleeping. I'm reporting this. I believe we held it till 10 a.m. the next day. I mean, I didn't give them a ton of time, but I gave them time. But one of the regrets that I have was I was a little bit of a chicken shit, and I didn't knock on the door after I knew what had happened. So I reached out for comment. I gave them time, but I didn't go knock on the door and say, hey, I just watched this all happen. I'm reporting it. I would never do that today. And, you know, that was part of, again, I did, you know, there's no, it's not like I didn't ask for comment. I did. But if I could do it over again, I would have probably, you know, actually knocked on that door and done that. And I didn't. I was scared. I was nervous. I knew I had a thing, and, you know, I knew I had a big story. And, you know, that was one of those things that, like, you look back, and it's not necessarily empathy. It's just maybe a different approach I would have taken. Again, I still would have reported it, and I think, you know, he ended up resigning several weeks later. I think all of that, whether it was appropriate for him to resign, that's on him. But the story was completely fair, accurate, and no one could ever challenge it. But it was one of those things that, like, again, if I could do it over again, a little more experience, you know, I would probably do it a little bit differently.
Yeah, I definitely remember that story. I was living in New York, and that's really cool that you were the person who broke that.
You know, yeah, it was a weird thing. It was, you know, I mean, I remember they wouldn't let me come to his, he had a press conference afterwards, and they wouldn't let me come, which, if I could, again, knowing what I know now, who the heck are you? Of course I'm right. coming, right?
You're coming, yeah. But you were with Go Local at this point?
Okay. I was, yeah. I was still technically a freelancer, but it was obviously a major story, and yeah, they were. I didn't understand the flow of things. So again, that part would never happen. But yeah, it was a really big deal. And I remember I knew it was a big deal. It's funny to show you the power of television, even though I was at Go Local at the time. I knew it was a big deal when the next day, on Saturday, after we reported it, I had a day shift at Greg's. And I was bartending. And I had one of those, like, really long, like 11 to 10 weird shifts, you know? So, like, all day, it's pretty light, and I'm, like, getting my stuff, getting ready to, like, actually make money at night, and the dinner rush comes in, everybody's sitting at the bar, and the TV's on, and Channel 12 has to report that there's this report out there that Dean Esterman had this party, or, you know, was at this party, and, you know, no one's commenting, and blah, 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 and to see it validated on television, like, okay, other people have to follow this, and then the bar watching it, and I'm like, I'm the guy that reported that. And I'm not bragging because it didn't matter, but, and they didn't know who I was really, but like the buzz, and oh, he needs to resign, or he needs to do this, or you know, that's kind of a BS story, kids will be kids, there are plenty of that too. That's when I knew, like, that was they saw it first on television. They didn't see it on Go Local Prov, especially then when it was really a startup, really in a, you know, very initial form. So that's when I knew, like, oh wow, like there's real power to this TV, and I think it certainly still remains that way.
Definitely. So in that moment, where are you at as far as a human being rationalizing the fact that you have broken, you know, the biggest story of at least of the day, but I mean, that was a big story of the year.
Yeah, it was a huge story.
With the fact that you're a Greg's bartender, because I know as a musician, there have been so many moments where, you know, you say, man, how do I get out of this second job,
right,
and get myself doing what I want, what I should be doing, because people, it's here. I'm like, you know, there
right,
it is.
Right. Yeah. Know? I imagine it's like, you know, being in front of a crowd and like really killing it. And like people are like way into this and you're like, how come I'm not a millionaire right now? Right. I imagine that's what it is.
Yeah. Or working, you know, one time I remember driving like a remedial job. And I heard my song on the radio and I was like, man, all right, you know, this is great, except for I'm making like $15 an hour to deliver farm goods right, in Manhattan.
Right.
You know?
And you're probably thrilled that you're making that $15.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's like everything right there. Yeah. So how do we, for all of us in like humanities here in today's world, like, because I assume you're not bartending at least full time anymore. You know, I assume WPRI's got you covered.
Yeah, they're treating me better.
So what's your advice to someone who's trying to do this and make a living at it? Because you've done it successfully. You've gone from, obviously the talent has to be there. You displayed that, but how do you make that next conversion?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things was being the opportunity I had at Go Local was incredible, right? I got in on the ground floor of this thing that, you know, look, people have mixed views of Go Local. They should. It's deserved. Like, it's tabloidy. That's true. It's by design, right?
Aren't they blocking a lot of reporters from viewing their stuff right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, me included, which is really weird. Yeah. I still have a great relationship with the folks over there, I should say. And I was, no, you know, the CEO was nothing but a gentleman to me. And we still talk once in a while. So I think the blocking on Twitter is a silly inside baseball thing. I can't explain. You know, they gave me a great opportunity, an opportunity that I probably didn't deserve. My talent was in, was saying that I was in grad school, right? I mean, it really, like, I wasn't even writing that much. I think I was writing at the time, maybe freelancing at the Phoenix, which, you know, at the time still existed, and writing quirky stories. And I had a blog, and I was writing a lot there. But there was no, I had no real, like, I didn't know, have any sense of what reporting took. Of, you know, I knew the fundamentals, but I didn't. And they gave me an opportunity. They, you know, allowed me to they gave me a platform, right, which is huge. So that was really important. But to the broader question of, like, how you do it, I mean, I'm a firm believer in just in really working hard and doing whatever it takes to sort of get your name out there, right? I think it's really important to build for yourself personally, that personal brand, and whether that's in social media or however else, like, really work. Working it. And this is kind of cliche, you hear a lot of reporters say this, never ever say no. I never say no to anything, right? Like, I'll do any interview somebody wants me to do. I will work any shift. I will work 12-hour. Yes, I literally woke up today after like a 13 or 14 hour day yesterday, and that's like no big deal. That's, I don't deserve credit for that. It's just, never ever say no to anything. Never say no to the next freelance opportunity, any of those things. And so I still, like, I don't have to. I'm fortunate. Channel 12 pays me relatively well, especially for a local reporter. But I freelance at Providence Monthly, at Eastside Monthly. Like, I'm hustling, right? And I think being a hustler really matters. That's like my, like, hustle is so important, because that's the only thing that got me there. It did not matter. Grad school didn't matter. Nothing mattered. It was literally like, he writes okay. I'm not a great writer, but I'm like, okay. And I hustle. And that is everything, I think.
I think so too. I mean, that really is the only way to guarantee you're going to get anywhere. Even then, you're not guaranteeing, right. But at least in terms of putting it in your own hands, right?
Right. Right. And it's fortunate, right? In the arts and in, you know, humanities, like you said, like, there's a little bit more of, it's not like playing baseball, right? Like, I just wasn't good enough. And like, I could have done anything. I probably could have taken steroids and I still wouldn't have been good enough, right? Like, nothing was going to make me throw the ball 95 miles an hour. It just wasn't going to happen for me. And so, like, that's really hard and that stinks. But, like, reporting, like, I can make a difference. You know, I may not be the best writer, but guess what? I work my ass off. So, like, I'm going to show up everywhere and people are going to have to deal with me. And, like, I feel like in the music industry, it's a little harder because, like, sometimes like, there's plenty of talent out there that's unseen. So maybe it's a little different, but I just think, like, never saying no, never, you know, never giving up is corny, but it's true. I should say too, initial success always helps, right? Like, I was 22 or 23 reporting and getting a following already. That helps. You know, would I be a reporter if at 31 now I was still bartending? I don't know. I might have taken another job, right? So sometimes that break at a younger age does really, really help. That plays a major role. I shouldn't, you know, dismiss it by any means.
No question about it. Yeah. Or at least being able to build the infrastructure, you know, so you can see how it would all work for you down the line.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Putting yourself, I think, in the right positions oftentimes, right? Like, I coach baseball, little guys, and, like, you know, they're kids. They're not any good, right? But trying to get them in the right spot, literally and figuratively, like, that's always my thinking. Like, try to get kids just to really understand what they're doing and why and what it means if we do X. And I think reporting in anything, any career, is similarly just trying to get yourself in front of the right people. Ted Nesi is such a great example. Like I said, sent letters to everyone. He was out there. It's like a free agent. That guy is the most talented reporter, editor, nicest guy you'll ever meet. I mean, he is like the full package of talent. He was out there, like, probably for really cheap 7-8 years ago, really cheap. And now he could work at the New York Times
he's
tomorrow.
He's indispensable. Yeah,
absolutely. He could work anywhere in the world. He could literally, I've seen the job offers. He could work anywhere in the world, and would kill it anywhere. And he's here in Rhode Island, and that's really, that's cool. We're fortunate to have that. But
it's a great resource, yeah.
Absolutely, right. It's great, for me and Tim, for sure.
No question. Real quick, you play kickball, and you coach baseball?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I play in the Providence Kickball League in Dexter Park with a Channel 12 team.
No way.
Yeah.
Who else is on that?
You know,
any on air?
Walt Buteau is on it, although he doesn't play as much anymore. Steph Machado plays. Ted does not play. We're just trying to get him to play, but he does. doesn't. Tim doesn't play either. But it's funny, we've evolved for a long time. We had, I remember like getting asked to play kickball, you know, like in just in any profession, like, you know, my first 6 or 8 months, like Tim and Ted knew who I was, but like most people, who was this kid, right? Reporter, or a bunch of us. And like getting asked to play kickball was like, oh, okay, like I'm in, like I'm with the cool kids or whatever. And we had lots of on-air talent at the time. It's evolved a little bit since, but it's so much fun. Our team name is Ball 12 for Action. And so, you know, it's like the spinoff of Call 12, obviously. And it's really fun. We really like it. It's a really nice, you know, the league now is, I think, 18 or 20 teams. I mean, all day long on any Saturday at Dexter Park, you know, you've got a bunch of adults drinking beer, listening to music, playing kickball. And it's competitive as heck. Like, I hate losing. I get really upset when we do lose, you know, not like psycho upset, but I expect to win. So yeah, that's, you know, like a fun hobby. And yeah, I coach Little League at Mount Pleasant Little League. I've done it for about a decade. I think a decade now. And it's really fun. I grew up playing baseball and I'm not good enough to play anymore. And so I like enjoy coaching kids. It's fun. It's also great as, you know, as I've become more sort of involved in the community and more relatively recognizable. I hate to say that, but you know, it's really nice to be able to give back to your community. People appreciate it. They, you know, you sometimes get stories from parents and league, you know, officials and things like that, but you know, it has nothing to do with any recognition. Just I like baseball. Coaching's fun, and we're really bad this year. We're having a bad season.
Yeah, I've ref soccer. I've been refing soccer for 22 years now.
Is that so right?
It's nutty, yeah.
It's fun, and that's a great like little side gig too to have, by the way.
Yeah, it definitely has helped me a lot, particularly in New York where I did it. Now it's more like in just my recreational department. I guess.
Yeah, you should play kickball.
To play kickball. Yeah, totally. I mean, it's definitely something that happened in Brooklyn as well. You'd see it in McCarran Park, and I'd always, when I'd be reffing soccer, I'd be like, man, maybe I should play kickball, you know, because I also love baseball as a, you know, on a fundamental level, even if I'm not, you know, day to day locked in with the, you know, the standings anymore.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, you know, one of the things that's really cool about 12, obviously, we have a sports team, and one of the things I really like, too, is sometimes to, like, go, and the sports team is situated in the same office as Tim White, so if I'm going in to bother him, I'll also just, like, talk sports, talk shop with the guys, and, like, it's really fun to just, you know, it always holds me accountable too. It makes me sure like I do know the standings or whatever, just because so I can like sound educated to the sports guys and gals. I just love that part of it. There's still like that drive of like, oh man, it would be really fun to cover sports, even though I really like what I do. You know,
well, maybe I'll be Brian Gumbel. You know what I mean?
Get involved,
but you know, whatever. That would be something else. A local sports one-on-one investigative series with you. You know what I mean?
That would be really fun. It's funny. I like. There's a great podcast that I listen to that is a guy from Sports Illustrated who's now I think at The Athletic. Richard Deitch does a really good podcast, and he talks to like how people get in the business, and he and I exchange emails once in a while and have for a long time based on like my like, oh, I really want to get into sports investigative or whatever. And so yeah, that would be fun. Although I really have, I think there's more work to do in Providence. So.
I would say so. Yeah. What's last question? What's your, I guess who more was a better way to put it? What, you know, in terms of a Rhode Islander or someone from around here that you would say is kind of like a marquee person in your life, you know?
Oh God, there are so many. I mean, it's obviously my longtime girlfriend Nora, being like just to keep me stable personally, right, is so important. It has always been supportive of my career and decisions and all that stuff. I don't think that's the question you were asking necessarily.
No, that could very well be that. That's a totally. That is the question I was asking. So yeah.
Oh well, good. Yeah. And then, yeah.
And then also more broadly, if you'd like as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, look, Nora, my girlfriend is just I couldn't ask for somebody who, you know, who, as I told that Dean Esserman story, I believe she picked me up that night after all of that.
Yeah.
Right. That's somebody who loves you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that just couldn't. And now, you know, we worked in nonprofits. We met at we both did the City Year program together, which is a AmeriCorps program.
Matt, is that through Matt Brown? Is he
I had nothing to do with Matt. He was gone long before I did City Year. But yeah, he founded it in Rhode Island. That's right. We met there and, you know, did a year of AmeriCorps, a year of service there, and worked in schools and really enjoyed it and kind of fell in love there. And like I said, now she's just always been supportive and understanding, by the way, especially when I worked at GoLocal, when I worked like ridiculous hours and like stayed up all night to write a bunch of stories, like, you know, never threw me out of the house or anything. She does yell at me because I have these stupid the AirPod things now, and so I'm the worst person in the world because I'm always on them and I talk really loudly, and so I'm like walking around my neighborhood at night talking to like sources, and she's like, you know, everyone hates you in our neighborhood. I should say,
well, it's better than being a musician or a drummer, put it that way. Try
exactly
that.
Right. I'm not drumming anywhere for sure. And more to answer, just to further that, I suppose, on the like who maybe people would know that are mentors, Ian Donis from Rhode Island Public Radio. I understood right away that the best way to get in and be a reporter was to know the reporters. And Ian was the first person who said, who like had coffee with me and told me, you know, what he thought, and we became, you know, now we're very close. We got Red Sox games together, you know, just very, very close. And he's a guy who, you know, when I was really, you know, again, making no money and bartending and just trying to hustle, like, introduced me to people at the Phoenix and said, you got to, you know, give this guy a shot. And has always been really, really supportive of my career, and I can always bounce ideas off of him. And, you know, something of a competitor, but also just a really good friend and a decent guy. So Ian is definitely, you know, at the top of that list, along with Tim and Ted. Certainly Ted, aside from all of the talent that he has always been really supportive and just a great guy. I mean, I can't describe, like, I'm so fortunate to have a lot of really just decent people here. It's so important, and we have a bunch of them. So,
yeah. Dan McGowan, WPRI.com, WPRI Television. Hear him all the time on WPRO. You were actually on NPR recently, RIPR.
Yeah, I do political roundtable from time to time.
Of course, Lively Experiment.
Yeah,
I love that show. I wonder how many people actually watch that show, because it's I see the YouTube views are low.
Mm-hmm.
It's so well produced and such an important resource. I wonder how we get that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I know we're wrapping up, but I love Lively Experiment and I DVR it.
I watch it on my phone when a notification comes.
So
if I'm on the street,
too,
like I'm watching.
I try to never watch it when I'm on, but I watch when other people are on. I think it's hard. All of the Sunday shows, you know, especially locally, it doesn't matter where you are in the country, it's hard to get an audience, right? Like, Sunday, if you're really into politics, you're probably going to watch Meet the Press, right? You're probably going to watch one of the Sunday shows. Maybe you're reading your paper. But people got things to do. It's hard to do. I do think I get an email, at least one email, every single time I'm on. So somebody seeks out to say, like, hey, you really stunk on this question, or you were good, or whatever. So I think there's always that insider following. The inside baseball crowd is, you know, always monitoring who is saying what and the opinion makers and stuff like that. So, the world needs, I want more people listening to your podcast. I want more people to watch Live Experiment. I certainly want lots of people to watch Channel 12 and read PRI.com. But, you know, I don't know what the answer is to get that to happen more.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, I agree. Well, thanks for coming on the show. I'm stoked you came on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great. What a great setup.
Thanks for visiting Bartholomew Town. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite listening platform. You may also find us at ripodcast.com or via the newportbuzz.com. Until next time, we'll talk soon.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.